Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me. Go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers today. With your gumboots on.
Countrywide. The politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hello there, I'm Isabella Pittaway. Coming up on the show, are the days of Ladyfinger and Cavendish bananas coming to an end? Work is being done to find banana varieties resistant to the world's most destructive banana disease, Panama. Also, would you consider sugar a natural health food? Many people wouldn't, despite it being derived from a plant grown in fields just like fruits and vegetables. But perhaps it can be healthier.
We actually make an extract that contributes to make a low GI sugar. And how that works is basically by adding some of this goodness back in. It's a complex mix of compounds, but all from natural from the sugarcane plant. And when we add that back, it actually helps the body metabolize that sugar in a healthy way.
That story a little later, but first, when World War I began, Australia's main focus was on recruiting, equipping, training and dispatching volunteers as quickly as possible, with little thought given to what would happen to the men when they started being sent home. The task of finding returned soldiers' work resulted in the first soldiers' settlements, including one at Beerburrum in Queensland in 1916. Many were struggling physically and mentally, and as amateur historian Paul Sutton told Jennifer Nichols, the 20,000-hectare experiment to turn nearly 500 soldiers into pineapple and citrus farmers on the Sunshine Coast ultimately failed.
Soldiers throughout history have been given land in return for service. So the Australian government and the state governments in particular were tasked with coming up with a plan, a feasible plan, to put people on the land. So in Queensland, in the early part of 1916, the Queensland government started to look at areas that they could provide land for soldiers to come back.
And they settled on Beerburrum because it was Crown land and close to the railway.
Exactly. It was in a very good location. So the proximity was a lot more important than the actual fertility of the land. In early 1916, they did send surveyors out to go and survey the land, and they came back and they said, yeah, the land's the best on the eastern side of the railway rather than on the western side of the railway, and they put the settlement initially on the western side of the railway.
And they were suggesting that they grow pineapples and citrus, and of course having the railway line, they could get them out to market. But
exactly.
Just how realistic was this plan in terms of you're getting these soldiers back, many of them wounded physically and mentally, really struggling to cope?
Part of the problem was that the governments didn't comprehend the magnitude of the injuries and the mental injuries that soldiers had in the first place. So they thought that, you know, by giving them some land is what people always want to better their lives. And so by giving them land, they were helping them by providing them the opportunities to better themselves and also provide funding for that. But in reality, of course, not all of these soldiers were farmers. And so you found that a lot of people weren't really suited to that way of life. Yes, a lot of them were injured and that, but these were not amputees. These were not people that had suffered major physical disabilities. These were still ordinary, you know, people that had returned from the wars who could be assumed could live a normal life. So I think the main reason why it failed was more down to the individual people, that they weren't really suited for life on the land. But, you know, the government saw that pineapples were being grown in the region, and particularly to the north of Beerburrum, actually more onto the Sunshine Coast proper, there was a very large pineapple and citrus growing area. So it wasn't completely naive to assume that they could suddenly start growing pineapples there. But I think that they were just overwhelmed by what it really takes to plant and to create a cultivation from scratch.
And I noticed with this that they were actually required to build their own home and establish crops to stay on the land because it wasn't freehold, it was leasehold. So that was all the condition of it?
That's right. It was leasehold. So they were able to get somewhere up to 40 acres of land, of which they had to demonstrate that they were settled on it. And they had to clear a certain percentage of it. So initially, the soldiers actually had to clear the land themselves.
And I reading this and imagining it at the time, they were using explosives to get stumps out, poison horses.
I mean, it was very, you know, very labor and manual intensive. I mean, to take down a tree, a gum tree of sorts that's been there for a few hundred years, they're pretty big. So they had to cut them down first. And there are photographs of the time, just the size of the trees are massive.
No chainsaws in those
days. Chainsaws, that's right. So they would actually have to go and cut it down themselves. So they were able to get the tools and equipment from the state, but they had to do the work themselves. Basically had to put jet ignite under them, blow them up and pull them out. So it's not uncommon for stories of people being injured because of that, of course. You then had to sort of fertilize the land, you then had to irrigate the land, and then you had to then start growing the crops. And pineapples take a couple of years from when they start to when they're actually being able to be harvested. So it was quite a slow process.
I'm reading one of these stories of a James Robertson Munro who was shot in the foot at the Gallipoli landing and then repatriated to Australia. He was talking about how he was struggling to eke out an existence. And he says, "I've had a very hard time of it lately, having to give away three of my little children for adoption. Too poor to keep them. I have three left."
Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of them, you know, struggled a bit. Again, a lot of these soldiers were coming from the lower social stratas anyway. So even without the war, they would have been struggling to make ends meet. Then putting them into a situation where there's really no support for them and they have to exist by their own efforts became harder and harder. So, yes, there's lots of stories of those sort of, you know, struggles of these soldiers. And some of them just couldn't deal with it. There was quite a few instances of suicide from the soldiers in Beerburrum. One of them, Sidney Dutton, he'd actually, you know, walked off his land at the end of October 1923, and he killed himself in Lang Park in Brisbane, you know, less than a month later. It was all just too much for him.
How long did it last?
Well, technically, the settlement ended around about the mid-1920s, about 1926, 1927. By that stage, most of the settlers had walked off the land. The government had sort of lost interest in terms of financing and subsidising everything. It was obviously a failure, although in its peak at about 1921, 1922, there was probably a community of about 1,500 people around Beerburrum. But that had whittled away very, very quickly.
And you did an amazing job along with the Adopt a Digger program to research a whole heap of stories and share those at the centenary of the settlement in November 2016. And the amazing thing about it was the stories you heard from living family of those soldier settlers.
Yes, that's right. I mean, none of the settlers are still around, but their children are. You know, Margaret Woods, who was born there in 1930, so after the settlement had actually officially ended, but people were still living there. She still remembers very vividly, you know, life on the settlement, dirt floors, no electricity, no shoes, no clothes, walking to school. She vividly remembers her parents telling her, "You've got to get home before it gets dark in case the dingoes will get you." She had to walk into town to get the milk, and they were poor. And what she said was that she didn't know that she was poor. She just thought that was normal. So I guess a lot of the people that were living in those sort of conditions, that was normal for them. They just put up with it.
Paul Sutton, what is the legacy of the Beerburrum soldier settlement?
That's on different levels. On the larger level, it's very hard for governments to orchestrate what individuals can do for their betterment later on. State intervention is not necessarily the best, you know, mechanism for giving people opportunities. But beyond that, Beerburrum didn't exist before the soldier settlement. It exists now. You know, if you look around the town, you still see vestiges of that settlement, the main one being the School of Arts, which was built in 1919. The street names, Bar Street, Johnson Road, you know, there's a whole bunch of different roads that are named after settlers, which is still there. What we noticed during the exhibition that we did, a lot of people, whilst they might not know the history of Beerburrum, they knew that their sort of community that came from that. So there was definitely a sense of belonging. And a lot of the people that have a connection with Beerburrum were able to express that in a very emotional way, in fact. So, you know, there's still a lot of attachment to the place.
Jennifer Nichols with that report. If you're health conscious, you might have a packet of this in your pantry. A global oversupply of quinoa has led to pioneering growers scaling down production. Kindred Organics in northern Tasmania were the first commercial growers in Australia. Despite the reduction, Peter Darman says he's still confident about the health food market with crops like spelt and buckwheat.
Spelt is an ancient grain, so it's kind of like an ancestor of wheat before all the breeding and genetic manipulation sort of went into it. So it's much lower in gluten and it's more of an older, nuttier flavour to it.
Is there any tricks to growing it?
It's relatively easy to grow because it's more of an ancient form. It hasn't had the dwarfing genetics into it, so the dwarfing genetics was introduced after herbicides came about. But the spelt grows almost to 2 metres tall because it's designed to compete with other weed species.
So the head is just a bit higher?
We have to windrow it for that reason, so it does lodge quite substantially because it's not designed to stay nice and upright and straight, but it does help with weed competition and it's more bred for your diseases and all the rest of it.
How much quinoa did you have in this year?
This year we only had 20 hectares. We usually have about 50 hectares.
And why is that?
There was just a bit of a supply glut in the market, so we had a bit of stock carryover, so we decided not to grow as much this year. So they've bred a bit more heat-tolerant quinoa varieties. It used to be very specific where you could grow quinoa, but some of the newer varieties that are coming out are more suited for larger-scale operations that can tolerate temperatures over 30 degrees.
Where's a lot of that quinoa coming from?
Peru and Bolivia are still the biggest producers. Around the globe, though, they are starting to grow a lot more in Canada and America.
China has just recently entered the quinoa market. Can you explain that?
So they are growing a bit more quinoa in China itself, and they've just recently lifted the import bans from Peru and Bolivia because they barred import from Peru and Bolivia direct trade due to the drug problems that were occurring there.
How do you expect that will influence prices?
Hopefully up, but we'll see how it goes.
So while prices are still down at the moment, how is it trying to make a margin there?
We're just trying to get more efficient with our production, trying to bring down our cost of production with the process and everything else. Buying expensive machinery that can polish and seed clean and stuff at a lower cost of production.
And you're still finding it's viable at this smaller scale?
Ideally was that we grew more, that we could put more through, but we just have to first see what prices do globally.
What else is done with the quinoa that you grow here?
So what else we do is we send some to a baby formula manufacturer in Melbourne. They manufacture it into an all-Australian infant formula cereal that goes all over the world to China and within Australia as well.
So how does it work? It's a powdered form and you add water?
Yeah, so it's a dehydrated form of cereal that you can mixed with hot water and then it turns into a formulation that's good for infants to eat.
How have they found the demand in China?
I think it's slow to get started. It was hard to get all the regulations and all the hurdles and red tape to get into it, but it's slowly starting to move there, so hopefully we see more demand.
And what are you growing more of now that you've stepped back a bit from the quinoa?
We have increased our buckwheat production and our hemp production.
Tell us a bit about buckwheat. How much did you grow?
We grew about 15 hectares this year and we hope to increase that next year.
Where does it end up?
We mill it in our flour mill, in a gluten-free flour mill, and then we package it and sell it mainly to Sydney and Melbourne as our own branded buckwheat.
Peter Darman from Kindred Organics speaking there to Hugh Hogan. Well, New South Wales rice producers need to continue to grow rice or potentially lose market share. That's what one of Australia's biggest Asian food importers and distributors says. High water prices and zero to little allocations has meant many farmers in the state haven't put a crop in this season. And Sunrise has forecast the 2019 crop to be the second smallest recorded since the millennium drought. Cherie von Hirschner caught up with Vivian and Stephanie Lamb from one of the major distributors of food into Asia to find out what kind of impact it'll have on their business.
It's a huge impact on our business because 95% of our rice business is Sunrise, which is locally grown. In the absence of having Australian rice to sell to our restaurants or sell to our Asian grocers, we'll need to consider other options, such as imported rice. And once, I guess, the market is accustomed to that import rice quality or pricing, it becomes extremely difficult for us to claw back that Australian rice market share.
In terms of the ethnic market, what kind of volume of rice would you turn out a year?
Last year, we would have turned over 11,000 metric tons of rice. I don't know if that's a huge volume for the industry, but it's certainly big for us.
And as you said, if you can't get the rice from Australian growers, your customers, they still want the rice. So for you to look elsewhere, have you done that before?
Absolutely. I think a little bit before my time, the industry went through a period of drought.
Was that the Millennium Drought?
That was the Millennium Drought. And I understand that there was a lot of American rice and Thai jasmine that came in and overtook the market share. And ever since, I think Australian rice has had to spend or invest a lot of money in regaining that market share.
So thinking about your customers, what is important to them? Is it the Australian rice or is it about price?
First and foremost, I think the origins of the rice is very important, and our customers actually do look for Australian-grown rice. Second to that, price is very important because running a business, you need to make sure that it is commercially viable. So price is important, but it doesn't take away from the fact that they place a lot of importance on Australian-grown.
And Vivian, within the operations, what do you think?
Well, I definitely think it's not only just about Australian grown. I think it's about the quality control, anything that comes from Australian branded. You know, we are able to monitor and ensure that all the safety procedures are ahead and there's food quality control to ensure that whatever comes out from Australia or is in tied up with Australian made or produced, that it is of high quality and standards.
So for those growers who are a little unsure on whether they should continue with growing rice once they have water allocated to them, what would you say to them?
I would definitely encourage them to continue to grow rice. I mean, that's what I believe.
The demand is there. Even for 2018, we actually didn't have enough to sell to the actual market. So, I mean, if there's more produced, there's definitely a demand for it. We distribute to the ethnic market, which is the Asian grocers and also restaurants, food service we call it. And I guess in Australia, there is the mainstream retail trade, which is the Woolworths and Coles, and they're very strong. But I guess the mainstream consumers, on average, consumes probably once a week with rice, but for the ethnic market, we consume it 2 to 3 times a day. So even though the mainstream trade have a lot more outlets than the ethnic trade, in general, our consumption volume is not any less than the mainstream trade. So it is a very big part of our business, and rice is a very big part of the ethnic market overall.
So with your networks, with where you distribute your products and thinking about the rice, how far and wide does your product go?
Well, I think through our Asian grocers, sub-wholesalers and Asian grocery retail arm, we go through the whole of national of Australia. We are distributing the same sort of channels in New Zealand. We also export all the way out to Hong Kong and even in China. And not only just the rice itself, but even snacks that is made from rice. And yeah, it's definitely a growing category for us.
That's Edison's Vivian and Stephanie Lamb speaking there with Cherie von Hirschner. You're listening to Countrywide. I'm Isabella Pittaway. Now, would you consider sugar a natural health food? Many people wouldn't, despite it being derived from a plant grown in fields just like fruits and vegetables. Of course, it's the metabolic impact that gives sugar its bad rep and why it's linked to obesity and diabetes. But researchers in Victoria say they're using extracts from the cane plant that reduce the amount of sugar needed to get the same sweetness in food. Dr. Matthew Flavel is the Innovation and Science Manager at TPM Bioactives, and he told Kayleigh Buchanan that the work could help repair sugar's image as a junk food.
We've been researching at the TPM Bioactives department for at least 5 years into the potential health benefits of sugarcane. So we've been looking into things that can kind of help manage blood glucose and a whole lot of health things, including cognitive health. So we've had this stuff around the lab for a while, and one day actually our technical director, Gregor McNabb, he grabbed some of this and put it into some beverages that didn't taste particularly good. And we actually found that, yeah, it improved the flavour by using some of these sugarcane products that are often kind of undervalued streams from sugar production.
Well, I'm interested because you said they're the health benefits from sugar, and those are things we're not often paired together, the idea that sugar might have a health benefit.
No, exactly. I mean, that's our real interest, is that what we think is that there's a whole lot of benefits to the sugarcane plant, and what we do at TPM is look at different ways that we can unlock those benefits, and one of them that we've just released a patent about is about sugar reduction, which seems like a strange thing. But yeah, actually there's quite a range of health benefits our extracts have been proven to be able to do.
So what can you tell me about the process of getting these extracts?
Look, it fits in quite nicely with the sugar processing streams, and so we work quite closely with sugarcane mills and refineries. What we're able to do is there's some of the, you know, the streams that are sort of often discarded during processing, we're able to process a little bit further and extract some of that goodness out of the plant.
And when you talk about that goodness, what are the beneficial attributes of these extracts?
Probably the biggest one we work on is we actually make an extract that contributes to make a low GI sugar. And how that works is basically by adding some of this goodness back in. It's a complex mix of compounds, but all from natural from the sugarcane plant. And when we add that back, it actually helps the body metabolize that sugar in a healthy way. It's something you kind of find across plants, actually, is that whenever you find sugar, there's often protective compounds that are kind of prepackaged that help with this efficient and healthy metabolism of sugar. And so that's what we really think, is that adding back this balance is actually really the answer to the obesity and diabetes crisis that's facing the world, not just reduction alone.
What do you think it could mean for the image of something like sugar and sugarcane in particular as previously considered an unhealthy food additive?
Look, I think, yeah, that's a real opportunity, and really opportunity for the Australian industry, is that there's a lot of solutions to, you know, this obesity crisis that are focusing on the reduction of sugar and adding in other things that aren't from sugarcane and aren't things that Australia is particularly good at making. Where here's a solution that is actually an Australian technology that's been patented here, and it's another opportunity for the sugarcane industry to add a valuable product to the food industry.
Do you think that this will go some way toward, I guess, redeeming the image of sugarcane?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the thing, is there's been a lot of focus on some of the negative aspects, and what we're doing is looking at the full range of possibilities that are locked in that sugarcane plant. It is quite an amazing plant. I think by broadening everyone's perspective, by looking at all of the things it can do rather than only making sucrose, I think it deserves to have a better image.
Do you think that's encouraging for sugarcane growers, for example, who might be feeling a little bit under the pressure from all the negative marketing around their key product?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the kind of big opportunity for the sugarcane industry to look at these other options to become more sustainable into the future.
Dr. Matthew Flavel speaking to Kaylee Buchanan. When it comes to bananas, are you a ladyfinger lover or more keen on the Cavendish? Well, the days are numbered for both. Researchers have been working tirelessly for years, desperate to find varieties resistant to the world's most destructive banana disease, Panama, also known as Fusarium wilt. Trials are underway in the Tweed Valley in New South Wales as part of the Banana Plant Protection Program and are closing in on new Panama-resistant varieties. Kim Honan is speaking here to David Peasley, who's been leading that work.
So that work's been going on for about 8 years now, and we've selected out a few varieties that are resistant and some are tolerant to race one, and they're now being tested in the Northern Territory and overseas for resistance to tropical race four. The verdict's still out on those, but the early results are encouraging.
We have a bunch of the FLF1 here, and you're saying that it's going to hit the market. How soon?
Well, we've got to get run it through the post-harvest research. So we've proven that it is resistant to race one. It's probably going to be resistant to tropical race four. agronomically, it's a very good variety to grow because it doesn't get leaf disease. It's a heavy, twice the size of a ladyfinger bunch. So it's got great potential at this stage, but we don't want to jump the gun at this stage because we did jump the gun with Goldfinger and didn't do the market research or the ripening research properly. So that's where we're at the moment. That's why we've put it in our third block, which is our best bets. Now, we've selected out three varieties from our agronomy block for best bets. One is the FLF, which is a likely ladyfinger replacement. The other one's a PKZ or PK2 from South Africa, and that's going to be a variety that's going to replace Cavendish perhaps. And the other one is a FIA 17, which is a variety from Honduras, which is suitable for processing. So at the moment, we've selected those three as best bets, and we've got about another five or six varieties that we're looking at as well.
So how long will the post-harvest research take?
Well, we hope only 12 months. So Matt Wernert's going to supervise that and done at Gosford Research Centre. So we're anxiously awaiting that because really you have to know the right conditions to harvest, what stage to cut it at, what humidity and what temperature and how long the post-harvest life is, because like with Goldfinger, it was ripened at the wrong temperature and it ruined that variety. It's a really good variety, but it was wrecked by bad handling. So we don't want that to happen to FLF. And there's some other varieties that we've got our eye on too, not only from overseas breeding programs, but if you look around at some of the tissue culture plants, and that's where FLF came from, it was supposed to be a ladyfinger plant, and it's just shown up exceptional different qualities, as Little Gem did with Goldfinger.
The FLF certainly looks like a Cavendish. It's got the size about it.
Yeah, well, we don't want it to be that big. It's just that it's growing in really ideal conditions here. But if it's grown on slopes and areas that are not as productive or not irrigated, then I'd say the bunch size will come down and the fruit should be shorter. Certainly don't want to bunch prune them. But if we're getting, 40 to 60 kilos per bunch, that's getting a bit on the heavy side.
Okay, so that could be, a year or so off, but right now there is a new banana on the market. You mentioned it, the Little Gem, and it is being, sold at least across the region.
Yeah, Little Gem's really exciting. It's a completely unique banana not only in its size, obviously it's very small, but it ripens very differently to Cavendish. You must never eat it when it's got a green stem on it because it tastes yuck. But if you let it go fully yellow, it'll taste like a ladyfinger when it first goes yellow. Then it tastes like a Goldfinger as it ripens. Then if you let it go till it gets black spots on it, it tastes like a Cavendish. So you can actually dial up your flavour. It appeals to young kids because no kid wants a banana cut in half. It's just a nice size for kids and for older people. But it's a good snack size as well. It's convenient. It looks good. Really good. It handles the cold weather. We've now trialled it up at Bundaberg and on the Atherton tableland, and it's looking really good there. We're getting very little waste, so the bunches are coming through clean and bright, and they're very good to pack. So it's an exciting time. It'll have to be in the, the upper level of price to start with because the bunches are quite small, but it's quite a unique banana. It doesn't go brown as well.
David Peasley from Peasley Horticultural Services in the Tweed Valley speaking to Kim Honan. And for today, that's Countrywide. But just a reminder, you can find details of all of our stories up on our website, abc.net.au/rural. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Until next time, catch you later.